So, good afternoon, and welcome to Yuma. Let's just get seated. Welcome to the rather transformed Yuma. This is a format that we'll have for today, and hopefully for many future events of this nature. My name is Shamil Jeppy, and I'm presently the director of Yuma. We are delighted to be hosting this event for Ingrid. I'm personally very pleased to be part of it, and that we can do this event for her. She has been at UCT, as all of us know, or most of you will know, for almost a quarter of a century, and has been a great force in the extramural studies department. And she has been writing poetry for even longer. She has, as you know, 6 collections of poetry to her name. Her poems have been translated into at least 6 languages. I don't know which is the most exotic one. I certainly have met an Italian translator. And while she will take formal leave of UCT, I think precisely on the 17th of March, she will, I'm sure, be around in other ways. I'm certain we'll see much more poetry in the months and years to come. I promised Ingrid not to be long in this introduction, about 70 seconds. I'm too conscious of speaking in front of such a distinguished and lyrical poet, lest my meter does not work. My colleagues will tell you, I can say something about kilometers being a runner. In any case, coming from a poor colored school, we were never really taught iambic pentameter. And I've always felt that I can't say anything about poetry because I just don't have the rhyme and the knowledge of meter. In any case, Ingrid's words in any form are always so carefully conceived and composed, just like her poems. So poetry is the art form and literary form that she excels in, and that we all know demands slow reading. It also requires careful listening. So firstly, during her poetry reading, please, if you have to leave at the end of a poem. Wait for it to hit you, and then you leave. So great poetry invites careful, slow reading and repetition. So it is a great pleasure to have Ingrid here to read mostly from poems already published, or all poems at least produced during a time at UCT. But firstly, I want to introduce and invite you to listen to Fiona Ross, who is actually used Ingrid's poetry extensively in her work. She's a professor in the Department of Anthropology and has been associated with Yuma for a very long time. Welcome, Fiona.
Good afternoon. It was an extraordinary honor when Ingrid phoned and asked if I would do this introduction, and I promised faithfully to be very short so we would have lots of time to hear her beautiful poetry. So I'm going to wave this extensive CV at you, and I'm not going to read from it. You all know her work. When I printed it out, it was faintly horrifying, actually, because apparently this is the abridged and rather outdated version. As we all know, Ingrid's poetry has been widely published, widely distributed, translated, and it's found a home in many of our hearts. I am not a poet like you. I know nothing about iambic pentameter, but I do know when things speak to the heart, and I do know when words hold ideas that enable you to think more creatively and productively in the world, and that's what I've found in this beautiful literature. So I thought what I might do, just very briefly, and I promised it would be only 2 minutes, was to situate the significance of the fact that Ingrid is actually a research fellow at the University of Cape Town, a very unusual position for somebody in the creative arts. As we all know, the creative arts are understood as something different, some other kind of production than social science research or scientific research. And her appointment as a fellow and in creative art, I think, was an extraordinarily brave and sensible move of the universities. So I really want to celebrate that idea that poetry is research, that poetry involves careful, slow, extended thought, the way that scholarship should, and that in its form it holds that, makes it available to the rest of us. I'm really powerfully moved by this poetry. And I've used it a great deal in my own thinking. I think my first encounter with your work was Terrestrial Things, this beautiful account, largely because it was about there are sections in here, as you know, about the Truth Commission. And I found them incredibly powerful and very persuasive ways of thinking about this moment, this historical moment of extraordinary complexity in South Africa's history. What I found in A Room Full of Questions was a way of thinking that hadn't easily been available to me from my disciplinary background. It was a way of thinking beyond what social science took for granted, a way of opening up spaces and a way of making words available to do things that I wasn't used to them doing. I found it incredibly thrilling and very freeing. I think that the kind of conversations that poetry has with social science are underrated and enormously important. It makes me very sad that they don't happen more often, that poetry, Southern African poetry, is not part of the curriculum for general social science and certainly not in anthropology. I really think it should be. Those words that are so tightly filled, that open up to gentle reading and to careful thought, to allow new ways of engaging with the world. In that delicate form, these poems are so short, they're so precise, they're so contained, and yet within them is the whole world that she promises to speak to us about today.
Thank you, Huma. Thanks, Shamil. Thanks, everyone who put this together for me. And thank you all for coming. In front of me, I have family. I have my goddaughter. I have colleagues, not just from university, but colleagues from my wider life. And, of course, special colleagues from my own department. Nadine Raw, my close colleague. And from CHED, Sue Ellen Shea, who has to leave early, so don't think that she's making a statement when she walks out. And there are fellow writers. I'm delighted that you're here. Especially like to say I'm pleased that Corinne Press is here. She's a close friend and interlocutor of my work and has been for that quarter century that was so cruelly mentioned. And Susan Speary, who's here from Canada, who's written about my work. And all of you, with whom I've had some or other friendship or collegial relation, I'm very happy you all were able to come. I'm used to speaking in a microphone. You can put your hand up if it's too soft when I read. But I wanted to mark my retirement from UCT with a poetry reading precisely for the reasons that Fiona, and we didn't discuss what she say, but what she said, is for those reasons, because this is both my vocation and my research. All my sabbaticals and fellowships have involved the writing of poetry, though I've done other writing too, that writing more understood as research. I wanted to focus on my literary life, not only because it's a significant part of my history at UCT, something I had to fight for, and though the battle is partly won, and creative writing is now understood as something that counts, i.e. it can be counted, I still felt I wanted to represent the creative arts in some way, what my part of it. There are people here from music, there are people here from photography, there are visual artists as well. And these are all so central to the intellectual life of a university and to its cultural ballast. And mine is a small contribution to that. Poetry in particular, of course, I do think it is the superior art form, draws the mind into itself. It mediates in complex ways both the effable and the ineffable, and mediates in complex ways everything else about our lives, using resources we share but usually deploy in other ways, by which I mean words, their weight and pattern, their dissonances, their origins, and their rhythms. So I'm doing the reading for myself, to remind myself that I'm a poet, not just a retiree, and also, I hope, for others. I came to UCT in 1989, after returning from Canada and after working at Kanya College, where the late Neville Alexander was my boss. And then I came to the Department of Adult Education and Extramural Studies, which was a marvelous department. Clive Miller was my boss there. And it had as its brief the teaching of adults, whether through community programs, diplomas, certificates, masters, summer school, or workshops, And it had a commitment to the development of a critical and engaged culture. Now, you'll all know 1989, well, some of you, not some of the younger people here. It was a very intense time politically. So that extension work with which I was directly concerned had a not unimportant reach, though a rather complicated one. But while engaging in that work and writing about these heady, turbulent times, as well as the hope that was visible on the horizon, I also wrote about the things that even the most committed poets write about: love, betrayal, memory, the family, childhood, loss, landscape, and the writing of poetry itself. The period of late apartheid grotesqueries, the tectonic shifts in the early 90s, the release of political prisoners, the return of exiles, the transition and its discontents, the much-studied TRC, the lamentations of and the lamentable response to HIV/AIDS. These were the experiences and concerns that energized much art and writing and academic work generally at that time. And I was no exception in my response to it. But my absorption in these realities and the ones that unfortunately have followed, including xenophobia, continued exclusion, the politics of disappointment, individual and social despair and anger, and the development of more focused forms of protest, never occluded my belief, personal, political, and poetic, that public history, in both its fractured and positive manifestations, is deeply imbricated with and in private experience, itself both bounded and mutable. The outer life and the inner bear the wounds and marks of each other, not as in a mirror, but in strange refractions. And lyric poems can also be refractions of everyday language, allowing us to visit things we once knew or thought we knew or are visiting for the first time. Now, I've been at UCT, as you heard, for 24 years. Actually, it's 26 because I was in the English department as a very junior lecturer for 2 years. And so I'm going to read, believe it or not, 26 poems very fast. And I do know that people have to go and leave. There's a chair here for you, Linda. And it's absolutely fine. I think that you can go through the back or the side, but it would sort of be nice if you left between poems. And if you can't tell when a poem ends, it means I've read it badly. The first poem I'm going to read is called Vocation. It's a newish poem, and it's a kind of statement of my life, I suppose, my poetic life. I led myself here, though the honey guide helped. There were other signs, as there always are. Father's compass to spin me round. Mother's messages in the air. White arrows at crossroads painted by friends. Childhood's morse, all seven senses. Warning flares fired by strangers. My country's graves, its electric fence. A backpack of songs, a map of words, even a rhyming dictionary. A Bible, 10 pens, watermarked paper. Most things quite ordinary. The stars, of course, were indispensable. Also the moon, though sometimes a bitter pill. And a little wind kept beating its veined wings for the willow and me to bend to its will. To find my way, I told myself stories. Ariadne's helped, but her silken twine encircles your ankles if you're not careful. And I am not lost, though things are winding down to a once-breathing house on short-term lease, where song, recorded lute, even pens scrape have almost ceased. From the crumbling roof, only one sound left, an owl's indifferent hoot. It swivels its head, tilts its tufted ear, casts its eyes into the dark, watching, waiting as it must, for me and other singers, other necessary prey, to find our ways through the brush, to shed our precious packs, mile by last mile, as we lead ourselves here, back to the beginning and the end. Silence, resting place. And the next poem is the only poem I've ever written about UCT. Although I referred once to my torpid job, but I'm not going to read that because it was ungracious. This poem I wrote when Pippa Scottness and Gwen, who's here, and others put together an exhibition in 2004 called Curiosity as a commemoration for UCT, and a few people were asked to write poems reflecting on the exhibits, which were exhibits really that were manifestations of the work done by researchers and others at UCT. So we got an advanced look at everything that was mounted, and this is my poem. It's called Treasury. When we label and display, we entrust our traces to the past, award them the prize of the present, or bequeath them to a yet-to-be-discovered place. In the cabinet of juxtaposed matter, each name, date, and time claims the space around itself, reshapes it as a stage for pageants or soliloquies. Each object of discovery sits like a mannequin, a favored child beside competing siblings, composed, mannerly, elbows in, Sarcoptes scabii, lead bars, ballet shoes, platana frog, waterproof field guide, titanium implant, anteater. Collection, exhibit, parade, explication of signs. These are our cables to a signal box of meanings, underground or in the air. Even if we believe in other magic, divine purpose and the syntax of the spirit, some realm where that which is mimics that which will be, we are obliged to chronicle in custodian grammar the processes and particles of the earth, to measure shape and weight, retrieve history, reach into the future. Talisman, relic, fetish, portent, we rub up against them like cats. The resurrection plant, its drought-resistant gene, a bird's blood temperature, demography, flight politics, seasonal calendar revealed by Dussie's tiny teeth, the heart in foreign lodging, lost language, fugitive tracks, their tracings on paper or in paint. In graph, key, index, we profess that what we make and remake in our laboratories of meaning compasses the sphere of nature and generation. But the world holds up its torn arm, torn wing, an angel or horseman reining us in as we enter the archive of half-known things with our quiver of blunt arrows. The early 90s, as we know, were very intense. I'm going to read two poems that relate in some way to that period. The one refers to a family house belonged to my aunt and uncle and grandmother. And when they died, my sister, who is here, took it over before it got sold. And when the exiles returned, we had a big party. But this doesn't refer to the party. It refers to my family inheritance, in a way. Transfer. All the family dogs are dead. A borrowed one, its displaced hip at an angle to its purebred head, bays at a siren's emergency climb, whining from the motorway. Seven strangers now have keys to the padlock on the gate, where, instead of lights, a mimosa tree burns its golden, blurred bee fur to lead you to the door. So many leaves, too many trees, says the gardener, who weekly salvages an ordered edge, raking round the rusted rotary hoe left standing where my uncle last cranked it hard to clear a space between the trees, peach orchard, nectarine and plum, to prove that he at least could move the future's rankness to another place. 40 years ago, the house was built to hold private unhappiness intact, safe against mobile molecular growths of city, developers, and blacks. Now rhubarb spurs grow wild and sour. The mulberries, the ducks and bantams gone. In the fish pond sage green soup, its fraying goldfish decompose the sun. Wax white lilies float upon the rot, and leaves in random piles are burning. Townhouses circle the inheritance. The fire station and franchised inn keep neighborhood watch over its fate. The municipality leers over the gate, complains of dispossession and neglect, dark tenants and the broken fence. But all the high-felt birds are here, weighing their metronomic blossoms upon the branches in the winter air, and the exiles are returning. And this is a sonnet about the time when we thought there might be civil war. Ground wave. Just below the cottage door, a moraine stairway of lemon trees, strelitzia quills and oleander shrub, steps to the sea and deeper terraces. The warming wind, concertina on the slope, coaxes open the bulbul's throat, the fig tree's testicular green globes, and camellia's white evening flux. Behind the house we feel the mountain's friction against our backs. Deep fissures are predicted by the almanac, earth and trees heaving to the shore. Scorpions come in at night for cool killings on the flagstone floor. And to turn to some more personal and somewhat more cheerful poems, a love poem. In a note, like a wishbone or the instep of your foot, this parabolic love curves, wings stirring in the neck nerves of a crane at marsh's edge, or bends its back into a kite, arching the membrane of blue flight. You breathe me out, I breathe you in. The smell of your skin is salt and tide and tin. The half-open door tilts cooler light upon the floor, and outside sounds come in. An olive thrush through the hibiscus bush, last evening note throating me under you. This much is all we have, shadows gathering, fugitive grace, and the deep body as our penumbral space. And a slightly less loving poem to a different man. Known to many of you here. Meeting after much time has passed. How are you, he asked, and was I fine, was I? I was, I said I was. Meetings between old lovers, haters, have a way of going along like this. Yeah, near, yes, fine. Hypodermic needlepoint, that's what it was like with us before. But he looked well, and he said he was well, and I was fine, yes. Older, fatter, but kinder, better, very well too. And this is another poem that's also obviously about writing. It's called My Muse is a Man. My muse is a man, not a woman. He corrects my first draft and my second. Not an icon, lure, or projection. No Dorothy, Beatrice, or Julia. He's a critic, a judge, and grammarian. He demands accuracy as well as passion, abhors emotion on the loose, imagination as excuse, glowers over spacing and spelling. While most muses are cryptic, wild, mild, or remote, or so I'm told, my muse has strong views. He asserts the primacy of sound, the way language must sing in and for its cage of meaning, is scornful of lowercase, the elongated line, the sentimental rhyme, generic trees and birds, harsh images of fathers. He recites the words of his real beloved, aloud and alone, though I eavesdrop in the shadows. Stand whoso list upon the slipper top. remembers everything he has read, believes the best poems speak of death, also love, but mostly death. That's why my muse is a man. I've spent quite a lot of time in Italy, and my poems have been published a lot in Italian. I'm not going to read more than one poem about that. It's called Merchants in Venice. We arrive in Venice to ancient acoustics, the swaddling of paddle in water, thud of the vaporetto against the landing site, and the turbulent frescoes of corridors and ceilings, belief and power sounding history with the bells of the subdivided hour on water, air, and all surfaces of light. What have we Africans to do with this? With holy water, floating graves and cypresses, the adamantine intricacy of marble floors, gold borders of faith, Mary's illuminated face, and the way Tintoretto's crucifixion is weighted with the burden of everyday sin and sweat, while the city keeps selling its history and glass. On the Rialto, tourists eye the wares of three of our continent's diasporic sons, young men in dreadlocks and caps, touting leather bags and laser toys in the subdued dialect of those whose papers never are correct, homeboys now in crowded high-rise rooms edging the embroidered city. How did they get from Dakar to Venice? What brotherhood sent them to barter and pray? And on long rainy days when the basilica levitates, dreaming of drowning, do they think of their mission and mothers, or hover and hustle like apprentice angels over the shredded campos and spires? Into the city we have come for centuries. Buyers, sellers, mercenaries, spies, artists, saints, the banished, and boys like these, fast on their feet, carrying sacks of counterfeit goods, shining in saturated light, the mobile inheritors of any Renaissance. Fiona mentioned that I wrote a sequence related to the TRC, and I'll read a few of those poems. The first in the sequence is a poem called Parts of Speech, which is about how one can't write about these topics. Some stories don't want to be told. They walk away, carrying their suitcases held together with grey string. Look at their disappearing curved spines, hunchbacks, harmed ones, holdalls. Some stories refuse to be danced or mimed, drop their scuffed canes and clattering tap shoes, erase their traces in nursery rhymes or ancient games like blind man's buff. And at this stained place, words are scraped from resinous tongues, wrung like washing, hung on the lines of courtroom and confessional, transposed into the dialect of record. Why still believe stories can rise with wings on currents as silver flares, levitate unweighted by stones, begin in pain and move towards grace, erating history with recovered breath? Why still imagine whole words, whole worlds, the flame splatter of consonants, deep sea anemone vowels, birth cable syntax, rhymes that start in the heart, and verbs, verbs that move mountains. The Archbishop chairs the first session. This is not an attack on anthropologists present. It was written after the very first event that the Archbishop started, and then he collapsed, as I think you'll remember. On the first day, after a few hours of testimony, the Archbishop wept. He put his grey head on the long table of papers and protocols, and he wept. The national and international cameramen filmed his weeping, his misted glasses, his sobbing shoulders, the call for a recess. It doesn't matter what you thought of the Archbishop before or after, of the settlement, the commission, or what the anthropologists flying in from less studied crimes and sorrows said about the discourse, or how many doctorates, books, and installations followed, or even if you think this poem simplifies, lionizes, romanticizes, mystifies. There was a long table, starched purple vestment, and after a few hours of testimony, the Archbishop, chair of the commission, laid down his head and wept. That's how it began. How to mourn in a room full of questions. The witness tells it steady, the breathing of a boy deep asleep, the way the young, even the watchful young, sleep. The windows splintering, shaking shack walls, raked breathing of the shot same boy, the mother and her spreading blanket. Old sorrow holds down anger like a plug, and juridical questions swab the brains and blood off the floor. The transcriber speaks. I was the commission's own captive, its anonymous after-hours scribe, professional blank slate. Word by word by word, from winding tape to hieroglyphic key, from sign to sign, I listened and wrote. Like bricks for a kiln, or tiles for a roof, or the sweeping of leaves into piles for burning, I don't know which, word upon word upon word. At first unpunctuated, apart from quotations and full stops, but how to transcribe silence from tape? Is weeping a pause or a word? What written sign for a strangled throat? And a witness pointing? That I described when officials identified direction and name. But what if she stared? And if the silence seemed to stretch past the police guard, into the street, away to a door, or a grave, or a child? Was it my job to conclude the witness was silent? There was nothing left to say. And just to conclude those as a sort of form of a prayer called Body Parts. May the wrist turn in the wind like a wing, the severed foot tread home ground, the punctured ear hear the thrum of some birds, the molten eye see stars in the dark, the faltering lungs quicken windmills, the maimed hand scatter seeds and grain, the heart flood underground springs, pound maize, recognize named cattle, and may the unfixable broken bone loosened from its hinges, now lying like a wishbone in the felt, pitted by pointless ants, give us new bearings. Now I'm going to read one or two sort of family poems. I grew up in a mining town in the Western Transvaal, what was then the Western Transvaal, and I've written quite a lot about it. It was the 50s. It wasn't the most pleasant time to grow up at all, but in the Western Transvaal, in the mining town, wasn't great either. But actually, I had a reasonable time. The poem is called A Few Questions. One died in utero, fully formed. The other twin had wasted limbs and became a real lady, dark-eyed, fastidious, family cartographer of birthdays, death days, feasts. My mother, neighbors said, had her hands full with the rest, meaning my brother, her first little fist to unfurl. Then me, spinning my hula hoop in a protective arc, and the youngest girl, who would take no help from anyone. My father worked by day and by night. When he did sums, we whispered and watched. The soles of our feet were country hard. Sun hit the stoop like a torpedo, but no one slept in the hot afternoons when tiny scorpions bred in a concrete basin beside the servants' room. Where was the dead baby buried? Did Sputnik see us playing in the felt? Couldn't Jesus make the lame to walk? Would a sinkhole swallow our house and car? If we had been quieter, would the sums have added up? In the cage, I used to be allowed to go underground in the days when children were allowed to at least once a year. It was very scary. In the cage. Once a year, I went underground to see what Dad did and to be brave. After dressing up, hard hat angling a torch, yellow overalls, oversized boots, the wait for the cage. Not the lift at John Orr's, my father's fellows joked as it rattled up like a snake. Ah, there are people who know what John Orr's is. Then the descent into darkness, where flares torched us into the wet sinus of the labyrinth and its precious artificial air, to wires and cables crackling messages from the surface and the ear-blistering hard judder of the jackhammers cracking the center of the earth, where, as we children knew, miners would one day find a bubbling volcano, China, or all the gold in the world. The men below smiled shyly. My mother said they missed their children. But I was glad not to be the child of an underground man. Eyes bloodshot, eardrums blown, rattling in a cage, crawling through a cave, while up above only a curtain and a bed and hot, thick paste with gravy for food. Orpheus and Eurydice confused me later. Somebody leaving, then turning back to look, and somebody else going into the shuddering darkness. When children leave, this is for those people my age in the room. And for the others, be kinder to your miserable parents when you leave home. It's a villanelle. Those of you who write poetry will know it's extremely difficult to write. And I'm not going to explain the form. You'll hear the form. They have to go. All children need to leave, give up their childish things. Open the champagne. It's no use hoping for a last reprieve. We're in this century. We're not naive. The bags are packed. Down comes the rain. They need to go. All children have to leave to show they're grown. That's what we believe. Though in some cultures, children do remain at home. Don't hope so for a last reprieve. It wouldn't help to self-deceive, to think they would be happier here. It's plain they need to go. All children have to leave. It's not as if we plan to weep and cleave to them. Pick up their bags. Walk firmly to the train. It's no use hoping for a last reprieve. They'll visit us. Their love can be retrieved if we can feign good cheer, our poise retain. They have to go. All children need to leave. It's no use hoping for a last reprieve. And some people might sympathize with this particular experience as well. It's called Last Move. My mother says wryly, this is my last move. To a smaller house, shelves fitted just right for her height. Shower with seat and handle grip. Caregivers next door. I say, not so fast. You may meet a prince, be transported to a castle through a snowy landscape, fur on your head, a muff to warm your hands. Or maybe a traveling man will win your heart with a bed under the stars. But she knows, we know, the last move will be to a place we only hear rumors about. Some say a mansion with many rooms. Some say silence and space. But certainly a place far away where daughters can't help out. I am going to read two poems about HIV/AIDS because I wrote a sequence on that, and I know that there are one or two people here who have used these poems in things they've written. The Head of the Household. The head of the household is a girl of 13, and her children are many. Leftovers, molting gulls, wet, unweaned sacks. She carries them under her arms and on her back, though some must walk beside her, bearing their own bones and mash, We're not on the floor in sickness and distress, rolled up in rows facing the open store. Moon and bone cold stars, navigational spur for ambulance, hearse, the delivery vans that will fetch and dispatch the homeless, motherless, unclean and dead. And a girl of 13, children in her arms, house balanced on her head. Women and children first. It's always been so. This makes it worse. Women and children first. First to be hurt, last to be nursed. It's always been so. When rumor stalks, first to be cursed, and worse. Turned out, inside out, only safe in the hearse. Women and children first. The new work I've been doing has been doing somewhat research into some of the foundling hospitals, in particular the famous one in Florence, which was the first orphanage in Europe, and thinking about how culture over time, different cultures have received abandoned babies, and comparing the foundling hospital, for Innocenti in Florence, with the babies who are abandoned or killed in South Africa as a result of unwanted pregnancies or HIV/AIDS and so on. This is, I'm only going to read one, a recent poem called Found Names. The police named her Precious, acid burn on her skin, long drop toilet, human stoop. A nurse named her Vicky Unknown Monday, rubbish dump, Lotus River, March 2010. And Moses on the banks of the Flay, valiant who was covered in sores, never baby X, never baby Y. For those who find infants know they must be named to properly be saved, to survive, to be recalled. We want to remember Agatha, August, Adamaster, when we tell the stories of cold, cords, maggots, rags, the foundlings without calls. Just two more poems before, maybe it's three, before Ian Scott says something. He's dozing off in the front, I can see. He's going to just say goodbye, so very quickly. So I'm going to read these poems first. These are really poems that are, I suppose, about the period we're in now. This one's called Too Long a Sacrifice and draws an epigraph from W.B. Yeats's poem Easter 1916, in which he says, too long a sacrifice can make a stone of the heart. The emptied shell hears the pleated sea grant clemency to wrecks and submarines. Forensic men in the archive of modernity interpret the statistics, tell us things are getting better. In boom time, the suture holds. The hungry share their begging bowls. Demolished shacks rise from the dust. Life goes on. We're told it must. But few who have been badly hurt are ever healed. In the wounded heart, there lives a need to hurt in turn, perhaps even to be hurt again. For those who queue in cold dawn air, uncounted by the census, the hope barometer falls, memory returns like weather, like drought and flood, lichen on a rock, like a riptide shuttling the unburied dead. What to do? Watch and pray? No benign conclusion waits in the wings, enters to pull the curtain down over hunger, grief, and hate. I'm only reading this because Judith Febri likes it. Well, sort of likes it. It's called Today I Do Not Love My Country. It's a response to the xenophobia in 2008. Today I do not love my country. It is venal. It is cruel. Lies are open sewers in the street. Threats scarify the walls. Tomorrow I may defend my land, when others x-ray the evidence, feral shadows, short sharp knives. I may argue our grievous inheritance. On Wednesday I may let the winded stars fall into my lap, breathe air's golden ghee, smell the sea's salt cellar, run my fingers along the downy arm of the morning. I may on Thursday read of a hurt child given refuge and tended by neighbors, sing with others the famous forgiving man who has forgotten who were enemies, who friends. But today I cannot love my country. It staggers in the dark, lurches in a ditch. A curdled mob drives people into pens, brands them like cattle, only holds a stranger's hand to press it into fire, strings firecrackers through a child, burns stores and shacks, burns. And the last two, one very short one called Mending. In and out, behind, across, the formal gesture binds the cloth. The stitchery's a surgeon's rhyme, a Chinese stamp, a pantomime of print, then spur, then trail of red. Scabs rise, stigmata from the thread. A cotton chronicle congealed, a histogram of welts and wheels. The woman plies her ancient art, her needle sutures as it darts, scoring, scripting, scarring, stitching, the invisible mending of the heart. And this poem's called Pilgrimage. I don't read it a lot, but I'm going to read it because it's about, you know, saving the planet, really, but saving the arts. Take a trip, take a tour. Go to newly bombed cities to see what remains in the rubble, scorched fragments or things saved whole. Statues, courtyards, a wash of painting, piazzas where people burned or still stroll, mosaics, reliquaries in crypts, holy sites, libraries, illuminated scrolls. Visit Baghdad to scan what's left of the beginnings of civilization. Bamiyan to reassemble in your mind giant sandstone Buddhas from whose empty cocoons flew the butterflies of the spirit. See Madrid where Goya still accuses. View the flattened towers of New York City, ravaged Mogadishu and Beirut. Then, if you have time, make a backward journey to ancient Byzantium and Alexandria. Traverse Bushman deserts and Aztec mounds, where memories hum in the sun. Closer and closer, while some still remember the detail, travel to Coventry, Warsaw, Dresden, Hamburg, and Hiroshima. Place your feet in the prints of the dead. And then fast forward with your guidebook to cities undestroyed. Go now to still breathing places of accumulated love and power, where the line of a drawing, an angle of light on a building, a word's gravid pressure on a page, the sound of a ribbed instrument, things made by hand, remade by eye or ear, have not yet been forgotten, raised. Thank you.
Good afternoon, everybody, and on Ingrid's behalf, thank you to all of you for being here. What a wonderful gathering. Undoubtedly, this is the hardest thank you I've ever had to say, not just because of what it means to me and others, but because what Ingrid's words and voice has, I think, done to us all. She has taken us far away from here and far away from rather trite words of thank you and farewell. But because Ingrid's work has not only been of this wonderful kind, it has been hard work to do important things at this university and beyond, and they haven't been spoken about. So I do have to say some little thing about that. I was asked to promise sort of one of these 3.5 minute things. I made no such promises. But I am aware that there's very little time. And I just want to make the point that 10 times this little bit of time would not be sufficient to begin to do justice to what Ingrid has done. I hope there will be time for it. Ingrid, thank you for that poetry. This is a farewell, and yet it's been primarily taken up by Ingrid engaging us intellectually, aesthetically, and emotionally. So she has been giving to us, whereas so often at these events one can sit back quietly and enjoy nice things being said. It does seem to me that that gift that Ingrid has given us is extremely characteristic of her and of all that she has done at this institution. Thank you, Ingrid. Of course, it is entirely terrifying to speak about poems and poets and so on, and I would never normally dare go anywhere near there. But I did ponder for a long time on how it can be that a poet like this, so skilled, so well understood and well known, can also make the kind of contribution that Ingrid has made at UCT, specifically through summer school, but through a whole wide range of other activities, events of bringing education to people outside of university, to communities, to community organizations, and to have been doing this so well for well over the 20 years. And it puzzled me hugely, because even though I have known, seen, and been told that Ingrid's work reflects a deep social awareness, sense of justice, big issues that Ingrid addresses, what has always struck me is perhaps what she alluded to and what Fiona alluded to, that they've been done in this intensely personal, individual way. And in order to point out that I was not dozing but pondering, it occurred to me very strongly in that remarkable poem about the abandoned children that what Ingrid does is to give names to small things, forgotten things, abandoned things. Every poem that I've ever read of hers has had a name. It's had a specificity. No generic trees or anything. A specificity that brings it close to us as human beings and not as politicians or activists, however strong they may be. So how is it then that she has been able to do all of this? I think it took me a long time to realize that those same qualities in Ingrid, the intensely personal, but the being driven by much bigger things, have been present in all her work. It took me a long time to understand that, to begin to know what it is to put together experiences of the kind that people are gifted with, whether it's at summer school or through some short course or whatever. So what does it take? And again, I'm hesitant for my own analysis here, but it seems to me that it takes what we see in her poems. It takes, in the first place, a deep knowledge and awareness of the world and what is important in it. We've got to find those things. You seek those things to be able to convey them to other people. It also takes knowing others extremely well, respecting others, to find people out there who have important things to communicate to us all, to understand them and to be able to draw on the essence of what they can offer in its huge multiplicity. It also takes being respected and loved by those people and many others, because otherwise they could not come. They would not come for some pittance of a lecturer fee to put themselves out and do a whole lot of work for this very cause. They wouldn't come, but they come. They come in their numbers, and they come with great willingness and, I would say, joy. And then there is the fashioning of each event. Each one is an event. I can't say it's a poem, but it is something like that. It is fashioned, it is given care, and it is the product of that care and Ingrid's talent and view of the world. With her close colleagues, this has been a huge effort. And it has remained, and I think been strong, because it has been so intensely personal. And what this has contributed to is actually keeping alive the idea of, it sounds so silly to say all these things, but community education, adult education, bringing what the university has to others, and to ourselves, of course. I mean, our grey hairs will be appearing at summer school very soon, instead of doing registration. So it is a gift to us all, and it's kept that fundamental idea alive in circumstances that have made it very difficult to do that. The closure of departments, the general strangling, actually, of this kind of effort. It's not just UCT, it's all over the world. And I think, I'm afraid, that it is a very sad indictment on how we see ourselves as universities and communities of scholars these days, that this work has struggled so much and has depended so much on ill-rewarded individuals to keep it alive. So thank you, Ingrid, and all of your colleagues that I've known, Madee, predecessors, Tony, Clive Miller, the other doyens of this world, of this whole area. Keep it, we have to keep it going, and I sincerely hope that new generations of people coming up will see its importance as we have. Finally, as one who's recently shuffled off some or other mortal coil of UCT, welcome to the ranks of us. One of the most profound things I saw a student write for us many, many years ago, early 80s, a black student coming from some horrendous background into UCT, who wrote, "I am one of the capable unaffording." It was remarkable, wasn't it? Capable unaffording. So now I want to say to Ingrid, welcome to the ranks of the sort of capable unemployed. It is a strange place to be, but it carries wonderful benefits. In the first, I just want to say two things about it. In the first place, it carries a sense, a rare sense of liberation. And I am trying to demonstrate that today by wearing disgraceful sandals to campus for the first time in my life. You too can have this kind of benefit in due course. And finally, it is a weird time, and we creak a bit, but I do think now, after all my 2.5 months of experience in this, that it is probably the best time to be able to think about and in whole words, and to think about whole worlds, because that kind of freedom is open to us. And Ingrid, I wish you strength in thinking of those ways more and more, and to giving us back some of what you've given us today. Thank you to you.